Regulatory bodies were huge benefiters of this new accredited certification. One, they no longer had to have their own programs. Many regulatory bodies had their own credentialing programs because they didn't trust the certification programs that were out there.
Accreditation, it's a way of life.
One of the actions that organizations are taking is to focus on issues of pressing importance.
What the customers really want out of their accredited certification.
I believe we have an impact on everyday's lives.
It's important to be inclusive. It is important really to be open.
And that will be one additional way to ensure that the voice of industry and user is heard and recognized.
Welcome to the episode 3 of Accreditation Matters. Today we are talking about the importance of accreditation for the public sector. I'm your host, I'm Colin Christmas. I'm the IEF Food Co-Convener and part of IQNet Association. And today I welcome a number of people to the podcast from the public sector. So we have Christina Dragic, the Director for Conformity Assessment and Consumer Matters from ISO CASCO. We have Mike O'Neill, who is the Head of Codex Policy and Strategy from the Food Standards Agency in the UK. We have Cynthia Woodley, the COO and Psychometrician at Professional Testing Incorporated. And last but not least, we have Elias Rafal, the Vice President, Accreditation Services and Standards Council of Canada, and also the Vice Chair at CASCO. So we have a wonderful audience today, and we're going to have a discussion about the importance of accreditation. So I wanted to start off with talking about how accreditation plays a crucial role in ensuring safety, quality, and sustainability of food supply in the food sector. So can we start with you, Christina, and maybe you can talk about CASCO and give us some insights for how you see accreditation.
Well, so as Colin was saying, I'm part of the CASCO Secretariat. This is a committee in ISO, the International Organization for Standards Development. We create standards that are designed for conformity assessment, those standards that organize, if I can say like that, the ecosystem of conformity assessment. I would call them framework standards for all the activities related to conformity assessment. So we have standards that are specifically addressing food and food safety. And they have been developed in a joint work with a technical committee in ISO. But before we go to this, let's say, details related to specific standards that are used to perform conformity assessment in food sector, I would like to maybe give a much larger view on the role of standards as part of the quality infrastructure and as part of everything that people need to trust when it's about their food and supply chains related to food. So if we look at CASCO as an independent, as a part of an independent organization where experts come together to write standards, meaning documents that are describing the state of the art way of doing something, then we can trust that these are global documents, globally applicable, created by many experts from various countries in the world, representing developing countries and developed countries. So bringing really at the table the views of a very large community that works in real companies, in related to trade, in conformity assessment activities. So these are the basis on which then conformity assessment is performed, the basis on which the trust of people consuming various food products imported from different countries could place their trust and be ensured that their food is first of all safe and sometimes also being having some idea about the quality of the food. So I would say that together with conformity assessment, together with accreditation, together with standardization, together with market surveillance and all the others institution in the international quality infrastructure contribute to establish trust in what we eat.
Wonderful, Christina. That's a really good summary about Casco. I personally see it really as the bridge between public and private relationships. And really that's built on a lot of standards, like you said, around the consensus-based model for global compliance. Very good. So with that, I would like to just hand over to Elias. What do you see how accreditation plays a crucial role from a national standards body perspective?
Thanks. thank you, Colin. So the Standards Council of Canada has the unique advantage of being both the national standards body as well as the national accreditation body. And the way we see it, accreditation really serves as the backbone of trust. I think Christina mentioned that in various industries, including the food sector. It's essentially about checking the checkers and making sure that the standards are not just developed, but applied correctly and consistently. It's validating competence, impartiality, integrity of conformity assessment bodies, and ensuring that they adhere to standards. It's about instilling confidence in the accuracy and reliability of the testing, inspection, and their certification activities. For instance, in the context of food safety, accreditation ensures that laboratories responsible for testing water quality, for example, adhere to rigorous standards and verify that drinking water, in fact, meets the regulatory requirements for both purity and safety. Ultimately, the way we see it is accreditation provides assurance to stakeholders, consumers, and regulators that products and services meet the established standards, enhancing trust through the supply chain.
If I may add here something, if you allow me, Collins, yes. Because it follows very well with what Elias is saying. He highlighted the element of principles and how accreditation works to establish a trust. I'd like to add by saying that the Casco standards, many of them, they contain these overarching principles that are more or less the same in all the suite of Casco standards. And these talk about the impartiality of the conformity assessment body, impartiality of the accreditation body. If we think about the ISO IEC standard 17011 that sets requirements for an accreditation body, there are requirements related to the structure of the conformity assessment body, when it's needed, related to independence of such a body, requirements related to the competence of bodies. So all these elements that are all included in the structure of Casco standards are those on which, as Elias was mentioning, the conformity assessment body function, therefore establishing this global system that allows then for the accreditation bodies, conformity assessment bodies to work together, to have a mutual recognition agreement, to allow then the regulator to recognize, mutually recognize the results of the conformity assessment procedure, which this established a very good basis for trade and for trade facilitation, allowing all this movement of goods and of course the movement of food that is happening today globally.
Christine, a good reinforcement from what Elias said there, and I couldn't agree more. I think the key words for regulators are independence, impartiality. And that really builds the backbone of trust in the whole system that's set up. And obviously that's critical for the regulators and the public sector. So thank you. Thank you. Now, I'd like to bring Cynthia in and just ask you how accreditation plays a crucial role from a professional testing perspective and how that supports some of the work that you do in your line of work.
Well, thank you, Colin. I think the reason why I've been asked is I provide a little bit different perspective on food safety in that my role as a psychometrician has been in developing developing instruments that measure the competence of people. And in the United States, competence of food safety workers was very fragmented. In the early 90s and prior to that, the landscape was just a patchwork of various jurisdictions having various requirements for people working in restaurants, working in catering, working in grocery stores. And so in one jurisdiction, you might have to take an exam. In another jurisdiction, you might have to have training. In a different jurisdiction, you might have to have both. And a food worker going from one jurisdiction to another might have to start over. So if you were working for a national restaurant chain and they moved you to another state, you might have to go back and take another exam. We relied on that system for many years. But then in the early 90s, something happened that showed us that that system wasn't working. And that was in 1992, there was a foodborne illness outbreak that affected over 730 people, mostly children under the age of 10. It was an E. coli outbreak that was linked to improperly cooked ground beef. And as a result, 4 children died and at least 178 children had lasting permanent effects from that, including kidney failure and brain damage. And I think it showed the industry that despite what we thought was safe food, our food supply was not safe for consumers going to a restaurant to eat. And so we went back and looked at the competence of the people preparing that food and decided as an industry that we would put our stakeholders together and develop a standard. And this standard is a standard for certification bodies who are verifying the competence of people. There is an ISO conformity assessment standard, very similar, ISO 17024. That standard was not available back then when we developed this particular standard, or we probably would have used it. But we developed a standard for accreditation of certification programs. And the American National Standards Institute stepped in, ANSI, stepped in to accredit certification bodies for persons against this standard. As a result, we had a large number of CBs that developed programs and became accredited, and then the jurisdictions adopted that process. So instead of offering their own homegrown mom and pop certification program that they may have had, they adopted the, if it is an accredited certification, we will allow it in our jurisdiction and we will eliminate our programs. And as a result, everybody won. We now have trust in our certification program. We can be assured that the person who holds an accredited certification actually has the knowledge for competent performance and to serve safe food to the consumers.
Cynthia, thank you. That's a really nice summary. And I think it's really important to reinforce that harmonization approach, especially within the US. If things were being done state by state, it was not possible for employees to go to another state without having to go through a whole set of hoops to be requalified to work in the food sector. That would have been a huge challenge. So I think it's great to know that. And ultimately, the elimination of duplication is key. The trust of the regulator is ultimately the deciding factor. And then the consumer will benefit who's coming to the restaurants, knowing that they have trust in the system. And even the food safety workers knowing they're working to a consistent manner as well. And it's not just a different set of rules in different states. So thank you for that. I appreciate it. And now I'd just like to go over to Mike from a regulatory perspective. How do you see the food industry supported by accreditation and the work that you do?
Thanks, Colin. I guess I'm here because I led some work in Codex on the use of accredited third-party certification by regulators. So that approach and what we have in the Codex guidelines is actually codify something that we do in the UK, but we call it earned recognition. And the purpose of that is to reduce burdens on compliant businesses. So we look at certificated businesses to derive some confidence that they are indeed compliant. So there is a role there for accreditation, of course, and that role theme I see emerging from the other speakers is that it can build confidence and trust in the certification bodies or the conformity assessment bodies. And I particularly like what Elias said earlier when he mentioned that accreditation bodies check the checkers. And for a regulator, this is important that this additional level of assurance is available to us and that the schemes are not, shall we say, marking their own homework so that we can derive some confidence from the businesses having a certificate and any data that those scheme owners may be prepared to share with the regulator so that we can, in effect, more accurately risk profile businesses or entire sectors and reduce duplication of effort of our regulatory resource, which, like everybody else, has a resource that is finite. I'll stop there, Colin, and we'll move on to the discussion. Thank you.
Great. And Mike, I really appreciate your perspective. I especially like the words you say for a regulator, it's important to check the checker, which is basically the accreditation role to make sure that there's a consistent interpretation and ways of working on the certification side or on the inspection side for analytical labs inspection for certification, which is for the on the auditing side, which is where the accreditation links both things. So great. I think that's a really good introduction from the team. And with that, I'd just like to do a little bit of a deeper dive with you, Christina, and the role that Casco plays. I wonder whether you could tell me a little bit more about the ISO 17000 series, the importance of having a common vocabulary, and a little bit more about what the Casco toolbox is and why that's important.
Sure, I'd like to pick it where Mike left it, because he was talking about the trust that regulators could have when they see accredited conformity assessment, when they see data coming from these accredited entities. I would stress that this is possible because we have this common, globally accepted set of standards that it's called the Casco Toolbox. They are standards created by ISO and IEC, and they all underpin the competence of the conformity assessment bodies. And if the recognition of regulator is possible, it is exactly because these standards are referenced in many of the regulations in many jurisdictions, and they are also referenced in the WTO technical barrier to trade agreements as being one way to ensure harmonization and ensure that there is a common set of rules, a common set of standards that are applied in order to achieve, in the case of food safety, mainly regulatory goals. Food safety is one of the main regulatory aspects in all the jurisdiction, that it's something that the government needs to ensure and put in place measures so that the citizens are trusting the food chain and all the food products present in the market. And this is where the work that ISO does, ISO Casco in particular, in developing these standards comes into place. So what are the standards now that are part of this family of Casco standards? So it's the so-called series of 17,000 standards, ISO IEC 17,000 series of standards. And as you are saying, Colin, the fundamental one is the ISO IEC 17,000 that establishes the vocabulary, establishes the principle, establishes that common way so that people understand each other, and also all the other standards being based on this vocabulary could work together. So we have in the CASCO toolbox a standard that I mentioned earlier on in this discussion, which is ISO IEC 17011, which is a standard containing requirements for accreditation bodies. So that is the standard that an organization like Elias's accreditation body and many other accreditation body in the world apply for their own operations. And that is the basis for the mutual recognition agreement that exists at the level of IAF and ILAC. So this mutual recognition agreement, based on the CASCO toolbox, on this series of ISO IEC standards, allow the cooperation between the accreditation bodies in the world, the mutual recognition of conformity assessment results, which what it means for the regular citizen and for the industry and businesses. It means that something that has been tested, a food product that has been tested somewhere by an accredited conformity assessment body, could be recognized as equivalent to results obtained by someone testing in another part of the world. But more importantly, it's the avoidance of duplication of testing or duplication of inspection or duplication of certification, where there is this equivalence between certificates, which allows that once tested, once certified, once inspected product, then it's considered as such in various countries. Of course, the regulators play a major role in this because they are the one that could underpin this voluntary mutual recognition agreement with their regulatory powers, and including in the regulation this voluntary way of ensuring equivalence of conformity assessment results. Now, I will give some other example of CASCO standards that could be suitable for the discussion that we have, which is around food and food products. For instance, we have the ISO
22003,
which is the standard that contains requirements for bodies providing certification to food management systems. So this is really specific for food safety. We have other standards in the CASCO toolbox, like ISO IEC 17020, which is the standard providing requirements for inspection bodies. And in some situation, there are inspection programs linked to food. We have standards like ISO IEC 17065, which is, again, requirements for bodies providing product certification. So all these sets of standards that you can very well find on the ISO website, which is ISO.org. And if you go to the CASCO page, you will see there the series of CASCO standards with a little bit of abstract of what they are about. So all this set of standards in a way organizes, if I may say so, the entire conformity assessment ecosystem.
Colin, I'm just going to jump in there because I think what Christina said there is very important around the vocabulary in particular, because when we developed the Codex guidelines, we wanted to align with those ISO standards that were just used. So most of the definitions that we used, and that's because of this term, the ecosystem. You know, we didn't want to confuse and create some new terminology in Codex that didn't align with the ISO standards. Although I must say we did add one on governance, which we thought we couldn't find in the ISO standards. So we have a definition in the Codex guidelines on governance because that's critical to whether or not you can trust. And one of the tests is accreditation.
Mike, that's a really good comment. I appreciate you jumping in and saying that. So I was about to say, I really like the term conformity assessment ecosystem. And it really is. It's a number of standards, guidelines, management systems and important information that allows us to do things consistently. And ultimately, the 1700 standard is really important to have a common vocabulary. It's really important that we have the same language, and that is the bridge between public and private relationships. We can't have people referring to different things when they're actually the same same term and same definition. So super important there. Christina, thanks very much. Mike, thank you for your comment to reinforce that. Christina, maybe just to wrap things up on your side, can you just tell me a little bit more of the role of ISO 17025 for accredited laboratories? On our side, ILAC is a key component for that, for laboratories. Why that's so important for regulators to have analytical data that they can trust?
Mm-hmm. So the ISO, this is one of the, another example of a standard that it's part of the CASCO toolbox, ISO IEC 17025, which is a standard setting requirements for testing and calibration laboratories. I think if you think of food, probably the first thing that comes to mind, it's testing. Of course, there are other conformity assessment activities, but testing, I think it's quite essential when we think about food. And this is a standard that is created for laboratories that do various kinds of testing, but also laboratories that do food testing. It allows laboratories to implement systems in place that will provide reliable results, which means that data coming out of the laboratory can be trusted, or you have a little bit more ways to ensure that that data is trustworthy. It's a standard, again, that has very clear requirements related to traceability, related to metrological traceability, related to validation and verification of methods, related to the use of reference materials, related to the use of inter-laboratory comparisons, proficiency testing. So all these elements, defined elements in the standard, place a high level of trust in a laboratory as being capable to manage the processes they put in place in such a way that they deliver consistent, reliable results. So based on this standard, it is an accreditation standard, which means that the bodies like Standards Council of Canada, the accreditation body that Elias heads, accredit laboratories, including food laboratories, based on this standard. So meaning that the accreditation body will verify that the laboratory correctly implements the standard. And this standard is applicable worldwide. So again, this idea of being able to compare results coming from various accredited laboratories, being able to recognize and accept results coming from different laboratories. Another element that is important to mention here is that based on this standard, the ILAC has a multilateral agreement, meaning that accreditation bodies that are recognized as being part of this network of accreditation bodies implementing ISO IEC 17011 and accredited testing laboratory, including food testing laboratories, according to ISO IEC 17025, they recognize their results, so the equivalence of the results of the laboratories. So I would conclude by saying that this standard, it's a cornerstone of, let's say, of the competence of testing laboratories, and it allows regulators to de-risk, as Mike was saying, or to risk profile various laboratories and the data coming from this laboratory, allowing their risk assessment to to decide how many times they do enforcement activities, when they do market surveillance for which product. So all this element of accreditation and conformity assessment allows the regulator to use wisely their resources and to be present more where it's needed and less in areas where risk is lower due to accreditation of testing laboratory or accreditation of other form of conformity assessment.
Wonderful, Christine. That's a really good summary. And I just wanted to reiterate the importance of that accredited laboratories, especially when we talk about food. We're not just talking about food safety. Obviously, the food safety is the analytical work around chemical contaminants, pathogens. But there's also the quality criteria that comes up with authenticity. So organic is one example. Even some examples of food fraud where it's not always a safety issue, but it's an authenticity issue. So that is a key piece and supported by ILAC within the IEF ILAC organization. So thank you for that.
Colin, yeah. I just want to mention something around that targeting of regulatory resource. So in the UK, where we introduced earned recognition in the animal feed sector, we recognize two schemes. We have two MOUs with those schemes. And what we've seen over time as we've evolved the approach is a shift from what was a near 50-50 split of our regulatory resource and official controls between high risk and lower risk premises to a nearer 80-20 split, where we focus our resource, available resource, on the high risk premises. And that's on the basis that voluntary third-party assurance schemes are sharing data, and we know that that data is reliable because of the tests that we've applied, one of which is accreditation.
Wonderful, Mike. I think that's a nice adder there. Really, the sharing of data is an avoidance of duplication, especially across borders from a regulatory perspective. It's really important. And that's one of the key drivers for IAF. We've already mentioned the MLA, the multilateral agreement to support the WTO, for example, and remove technical barriers to trade. So the more regulators and the public sector can share data and results, the better I think it is for the whole food sector to avoid that kind of duplication that may happen if we don't monitor it. So good. Christina, thanks for that summary. Mike, thanks for your comments as well. What I would like to do now is to bring Elias in. And Elias, I'd like you to talk a little bit more about the work the Standards Council of Canada are doing and how that ties into accreditation.
Thanks again, Colin. Certainly, as I've mentioned earlier, Standards Council of Canada is both the national standards body as well as the national accreditation body. So that gives us a bit of a unique advantage. We're also part of the federal government. And why is that important? Well, it gives us special access to developing partnerships with government departments as well as regulators. In the realm of food safety, quality and sustainability is very important. And one significant example of that partnership is with the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, or CFIA. This helps us protect consumers and safeguard Canada's reputation for quality fish and seafood. CFIA is responsible, among other things, for laboratories conducting testing to verify food safety, animal health, as well as plant protection standards. And they require accreditation to ISO IEC 17025. Mm-hmm. Christina talked at length about that, so I'm not going to go over that in any more detail. But essentially, the value here is that accredited testing really offers several advantages over non-accredited testing, including rigorous adherence to international standards, but also regular proficiency testing and ongoing evaluation of technical competency. As an example, in the agriculture industry, our collaboration with CFIA plays a critical role in upholding Canada's reputation for high quality fish and seafood. partnership really exemplifies how accreditation can bolster regulatory oversight and instilling confidence in the management of aquatic animal health among trading partners. So consequently, the consumers and trading partners alike can place significant trust in Canada's diagnostic testing and the management of aquatic animal health. I'll just shift gears a little bit, Colin, and talk a little bit about something else that we're doing. So I talked about our partnerships, and as we continue to strengthen those partnerships and initiatives in food safety, we're also looking towards the future and emerging challenges in data governance, interoperability, of course, demand special solutions, and SCC is at the forefront of addressing some of these challenges, particularly in leveraging technologies such as artificial intelligence. So a few challenges that we see, and I think Mike talked a little bit about this, the lack of integration among various sectors, including agri-food and agriculture, has led to fragmented data systems and limited information sharing across the food chain. So this hampers efforts in ensuring traceability, transparency in food production methods, and making it quite difficult for consumers to access crucial information about their food. What we're doing is developing an artificial intelligence management system, and right now it's in the pilot stage, and we're aiming to bridge these gaps by leveraging digital technologies like artificial intelligence. As a sector, through standards like the newly published ISO IEC 42001, so that's the artificial intelligence management systems, we can provide the world really with a trusted framework for responsible AI use in industries like the food industry. So at SCC, through the rigorous accreditation conformity assessment pilot testing that we're going through today, we're working in innovative ways to leverage standardization so that AI is deployed ethically and effectively, essentially safeguarding both consumers and businesses. Thanks, Colin.
Elias, a really good summary about what Standards Council are doing, and your work with the Canadian government is critical. And I think that that's important, that a lot of the standards organizations are very closely linked, and accreditation bodies are closely linked to government agencies. So that really is an important factor of things. That partnership really does build that level of trust and independence in terms of the standard setting process and the execution, certification and testing. So I really like that. The second piece you mentioned about AI. So this is a podcast, we're talking about food. And then we're now conveniently or interestingly brought in AI. And I think that's so important, because with the IEF and ILAC, it supports the food sector. So the subsectors of food are food safety, food quality, but then we also consider things like the environmental impacts. We look at worker safety, and ultimately, how do you piece all that together? And in a lot of cases, you've mentioned there's fragmentation because the different organizations doing working in those subsectors, but not actually always connecting the dots. And I think that's really important, that I think technology will be play a critical role, especially around traceability and transparency to bring that in, because it's information collection that is looking at all of those different food subsectors. And I think that's going to be a fascinating part to how do we get that into connectivity in food supply chains from farm to fork. So really happy that you're looking at standards such as ISO 42001, which has been recently published, and doing pilots in this area. I think ultimately that's the ties in nicely to World Accreditation Day. So that's going to be on June 9 this year. And that the theme this year is shaping the future. So really you see forward thinking organizations that such as yours looking maybe 10, 20 years ahead and trying to solve some of the problems with tomorrow's tools, and not trying to fix things with processes that we already have in place that may be causing fragmentation.
Colin, if I may chip in, We at FSA are also looking at AI, of course. So I'm aware we recently developed a model that corrects commodity codes to prevent shipments, consignments being rejected at the border before they arrive. But I really wanted to mention actually the data sharing, which you said is critical, or you acknowledge was critical, because that was really one of the thorniest issues in the development and agreement of the Codex guidelines. And it's actually how that data is secured and held and shared and used. So I mentioned our earned recognition in the animal feed sector. We receive anonymized and aggregated data. I think from the Red Tractor, it's 4,000 audits a quarter. So that builds up a huge kind of data set on particular areas of interest to us as the regulator to spot trends and things. We don't and have not yet asked for facilities level data. We only do that if we know there's a significant public health risk or imminent public health risk, and we need to get in there quickly. And that's also in the Codex guidelines, that ability to do that, you know, in partnership with the third party assurance owners.
Mike, I think that's an important comment there. So thanks for reiterating the importance of the technology, information, and the role that AI is going to impact on the food sector. I think maybe the last piece I would say with the food sector, the future of the food sector going to be more heavily reliant upon data exchange and having trusted information. Another standard that is really important that's going to support the food sector is ISO 27001 for information data security. So that plays another key role, and we'll see in the huge amount of growth in adoption of that standard in the food sector as well, from farm to fork. So thank you. Thank you, Elias, and thanks for your comments to support that, Mike. Now I'd like to come back to you, Cynthia. You touched upon a really interesting case study that led to improvements of food safety in the catering industry as a result of a foodborne outbreak in the 1990s in the US. Maybe you can touch upon that and give us a little bit more information about how workers are verified and the standards that you work on and the benefits that you're seeing as well to the public.
Absolutely. Thank you. So as I mentioned, prior to that foodborne illness outbreak, the landscape of verifying competence of restaurant workers and grocery store workers, anyone in the catering business who touches food, was fragmented and obviously wasn't working because we had several foodborne illness outbreaks. When we got together all of the stakeholders and developed the standard and implemented an accreditation process for accrediting certification bodies, we ended up with a program that benefits so many individuals, not just the certified persons. But let's start with the certified person. Previous to that, as I mentioned, the certified person would be certified, and if they moved to another jurisdiction, they may have had to take an exam again, they may have had to take training again. There was no guarantee of the quality of the certification program because there was nobody looking at the CBs, the certification bodies for persons, to make sure the program they were offering was valid and reliable and had any kind of validity in terms of meeting best practice standards for certification of persons. Once we implemented the program, though, then it comes back to what others have said already. It comes back to trust. You can now trust that the certification body for persons actually is doing what it purports to do. It's verifying the competence of the food worker. And so for a candidate, now when they get a certification from an accredited certification body, they can feel confident that they actually know what they need to know in order to protect the food. They know what temperatures they should be cooking food to. They know how to safely store and serve food. So for the candidate, that's a benefit in that they can trust the certification body they're going to is actually doing things the way they're supposed to. It's also a benefit to them in that now what a candidate can look for isn't which one is the easiest or which one has the best reputation, because they're all equivalent. Accreditation bodies are equivalent. What the candidate can look for is access, for example. Which one can I get to easier, or price? Which one can I afford to go to? Because we know the quality of all of the accredited certification bodies are the same. Employers also benefit from this accredited certification bodies, because they no longer have to decide themselves, am I hiring someone who knows what temperature to cook food to, or who knows how to store food properly? I am hiring someone who has accredited certification. I know that their competence has been verified, and so I can trust that that certification means something and they will know what they need to do in the restaurant or in the grocery store. Regulatory bodies were huge benefiters of this new accredited certification. One, they no longer had to have their own programs. Many regulatory bodies had their own credentialing programs because they didn't trust the certification programs that were out there. So instead of having to spend the funds to develop their own program or to hire individuals who verified the quality of certification programs, they could rely on accredited certification and instead focus on doing inspections, which is what we want them to do. The interesting thing that came out of this was the U.S. Center for Disease Control, CDC, issued a letter that showed that once we brought accredited certification to food safety and restaurants, they had evidence that the number of food violations in the kitchens and restaurants went down. They actually had that data and they shared it via a letter that they put out to the industry that said accredited certification works. It absolutely has reduced it has reduced the number of food safety violations we have found. Yeah. And so regulatory bodies can also be satisfied with the process and have confidence now that, and trust is the word we used earlier, have trust that the programs work, basically. And ultimately, the person that's most protected, the public, right? We want the pub. You want to feel comfortable that when you go to a restaurant or you go to a grocery store and you buy something from the deli, that the food is safe, that it's been properly stored, it's been properly cooked, it's safe for you to eat. And so the public can trust in the system as a result of accredited certification of persons.
Cynthia, I am fascinated by this story of the certified workers, the competency of persons. It's really important that we have case studies that are endorsed by regulators such as the CDC. And if there's a reduction in citations as a result of certified persons, the benefit is ultimately to the public. We started off with you explaining a sad story of a foodborne illness in the 90s that led to consumer deaths and consumer hospitalizations. And then we finish with where we are today with case studies saying that there's been huge improvements in the US as a result of the work of accredited certification. So thanks for sharing that with us. And I really am fascinated by that story, as I mentioned. So, Mike, I would like to come back to you. And as you mentioned before in the introduction, one of the reasons why you are here is really to explain to everyone about the work that you did with Codex for voluntary third-party assessments and how regulators can use that based on a set of recommendations from Codex. Maybe you can give us a little bit more about the work you've done there and the other things that's coming out of the work that you do in the UK.
Yes, of course. So probably first a little bit of background on why we've done work in Codex on the use of voluntary third-party assurance. I think it was back in about 2015, there was a paper, it's a standard agenda item on the Codex Committee for Food Import Export Certification Systems, committee hosted by Australia that horizon scans and looks at emerging issues. And there was a reference in that paper to the increased use of private quality assurance schemes by food businesses. And I think when we say increased use 2015, that's not the UK. The UK has been using private quality assurance schemes for quite some time, a number of years. I think it's the a recognition that globally these were gathering pace with initiatives such as the GFSI and their benchmark schemes. So the UK and Canada put their hand up and said, we'd like to do a discussion paper on that. We prepared a discussion paper and we took it to the following meeting of CCFIX and included a new work proposal and said, it's timely now to address this and provide some guidelines for members. So what's in that approach? As I said, the UK has a track record of private quality assurance schemes, such as the British Retail Consortium, the Red Tractor Assurance Scheme, many others, but also this earned recognition, this approach that we use in the UK and have used in varying guises since around 2004, 2005. So we thought we can help, we can provide something that's flexible in an international guideline. So about the approach, it is public-private partnership. It's a working model, but it's built on transparency and now an international standard adopted in 2021. And it's used to support a national food control system, so the regulatory oversight. But it doesn't change any of the roles and responsibilities. The guidelines include and make clear what those roles and responsibilities are for the various actors in the regulatory and third-party ecosystem. Because it's important, I think, when we were developing the text that everybody understood, because we were going to work in partnership with the industry, we were not privatizing official controls. And the responsibilities that we had in the UK, it's in our vision, food is safe and what it says it is, right? So we're not giving that over to the private sector, despite them having a responsibility in law to produce safe food. It's also flexible, because countries and their systems and how they structure their control systems are different. So you need the ability to be able to tailor the approach to meet your national settings and circumstances. And it is predicated on the ability to assess the integrity and credibility of a third-party assurance scheme and its governance, how it operates in practice, and its willingness to share some of that information and data with the regulator. And as I said, in the UK, in a aggregated and anonymous format, so that we can use that data to more accurately risk profile businesses and sectors, and once we're able to do that, we can better target our regulatory resource. I gave a figure earlier how we, over time, have managed to shift the burden from the businesses we are fairly confident are compliant to businesses that we think could do more and should do more to be compliant. So that does reduce the regulatory burden on those compliant businesses. And when we say reduce the burden, everybody knows that businesses have complained about audit fatigue for many, many years. They have second party, third party, and the regulator going in, you know, very frequently, actually. So it's a win-win, and that's how it's described even by the third-party scheme owners that we have in the UK, that we have these arrangements with, because they benefit their businesses or members of their schemes, certificated businesses, can also benefit.
Mike, a really good summary, and I think that last point just reinforced that there had been a lot of fatigue, audit fatigue in the industry, regulators, second party audits, third party audits. We've seen a huge amount of harmonization. That's been driven, as you mentioned, from an industry perspective with GFSI. And on top of that, with the important work you did for Codex, that now helps regulators and government authorities use some of the data from these voluntary certification schemes that allows you to adjust your risk profile and inspect with more data-driven information for decision-making.
Colin, I guess I should add that, you know, in very critical to the guidelines is the section assess the integrity and credibility of a third party assurance scheme. And there's two key sections in there that cover accreditation. There's the governance arrangements, and that's quite specific in that it mentions, does the VTPA program have an accreditation arrangement with an accreditation body with international standing? And the reference and footnote there is to the IAF. Though I must say, you know, perhaps going off script a little bit, that we also recognize that IAF has around about 100 members. Codex has 188 members. So if we have a guideline that can be used by 188 members, we have to give them some flexibility there, which I mentioned earlier. The guidelines are flexible and can be tailored to a country's national circumstances. So there is mention about where there isn't an accreditation body with that standing. How would the competent authority satisfy itself that the certification body has the necessary capacity and competency to perform effectively? And, you know, there's not too much in the guidelines around that. It's a rare situation, but UNIDO has produced a toolkit that would help an authority navigate that particular circumstance. The other section of the guidelines in the integrity and credibility is the accreditation of certification bodies. And there's four bullets there asking questions so that the competent authority can satisfy themselves that there is indeed a robust arrangement in place with an accreditation body for that certification body. So I think, you know, with that in mind, Colin, that shows that the approach does take account of and derive confidence from accreditation where that exists. And in the UK, earned recognition, I mentioned a couple of our schemes, they are required to be accredited to ISO 17065. That's a fact. And that's one of the criteria we set in our approach way back in about 2012 when we adopted this approach.
That's a really important adder to reinforce those points that the guidance is really reinforcing the importance of accreditation, offering some flexibility for exceptions as well. So good. I think as well, maybe just to wrap that up as well, we see you mentioned some work of UNIDO. We're also aware of there's various commission communications from the EU, and they have a best practice guideline for voluntary certification schemes for agricultural products and foodstuffs as well. So within certain regions of the world, we're seeing a lot of this guidance that comes out to support that bridge between the public and the private sector. So thank you, Mike. So good. We've kind of gone around and spoke to everyone today, and it's been really fascinating to hear the different perspectives. What I would say to reinforce is the food sector is a complicated thing from farm to fork, as we mentioned, and no one's going to have all the answers. So it's really important, and this is the work with IAF and ILAC, is the collaboration. So the collaboration piece for me is really important. It's important we have the dialogue, which is why we're having the podcast today. So with that, I'd just like to go around the table and see if there's any final thoughts just on accreditation in terms of supporting the food sector, food systems, and impact on things like quality infrastructure, which is supported by IDF and ILAC and CASCO as well. So, Christina, any final thoughts from you?
Thank you very much, Colin. I think what the conclusion, or at least the one of the elements of the discussion today, is about an international system that is the international quality infrastructure that includes the accreditation, conformity assessment, the standards and standard writers, standardization as an activity, includes the market surveillance, the role that the regulatory bodies play in this system. So what I'm trying to underline here, and I think all of us coming from various perspectives emphasized today, it's this integrated system where you have various actors that work in sync. When things are progressing and are successful, is because all these actors work together. The other element that it's applicable to standards and to ISO IEC standards, to the CASCO toolbox, and helps the entire system, is the fact that they are constantly looked at and revised. Cynthia was mentioning ISO IEC 17024, which is the standard at the basis of certification of persons. This standard is currently in revision. There are many other standards that systematically they come up for revision. And what this means that we are able to integrate changes in technology, are able to integrate feedback from the users of the standards, including feedback from regulators. We are able to adapt and modify the standard in such a way that it responds to the present needs. We can include elements related to artificial intelligence, for instance. Elias was mentioning this earlier. We could include elements coming from analyzing the data, and seeing where the issues are, including the risk type of thinking in the standard. So what I'm trying to underline here is that standardization as part of this ecosystem is an actor that is agile, that can adapt to the requirements of the market and of the users, and all resides on everyone participating to the standardization efforts. So again, what you were saying earlier, we have a quality infrastructure, and the quality infrastructure is applicable in many instances with a lot of success in the food system.
Christina, thank you very much for that summary. I appreciate it. Elias, any final thoughts on your side?
Sure, and I'll be very brief, Colin, because Christina touched on a lot of the items I was going to touch on. But I think one of the key success factors to supporting the environment, animal welfare, and provenance is really leveraging standardization as a regulatory tool. For us, as I've mentioned, forming strategic partnerships with government departments at all levels was critical for us to move the needle. I'll conclude by saying that relying on accredited conformity assessment bodies, regulators can streamline their processes, they can reduce costs, and they can certainly target interventions effectively, thereby simplifying the regulatory compliance. Thank you, Colin.
Thank you, Elias. Over to you, Cynthia. Any final thoughts?
Yes, thank you, Colin. So I think I'd like to end by saying people are the key. The competence of people are the key. We can make sure that products arrive at our restaurants are safe, but if in the end, if people mishandle the products before they serve the consumer, then we've done it all for nothing. So competence of people and their work is really the key to ensuring safe food, and certification bodies which verify the competence of the people might be doing a great job, but they also might not be doing a great job. As much as we hate to admit it, there are unethical certification bodies out there that are just paper mills that just give you a certificate. And what accreditation offers is it offers the trust in the certification body. It is third-party verification that the certification body is doing the job of verifying the competence of the person correctly. And so it just, in the ecosystem, as you talked about, it just verifies that we now know we can hold a person accountable because they knew better. They understood what was proper behavior in ensuring safe food for the public.
Cynthia, a nice summary there. Thank you very much. Last but not least, any final thoughts from you, Mike?
Yeah, thanks, Colin. I think I'd like to recognize the role IAF have as a convener here, you know, bringing this group together even, but also the accreditation bodies, the 100 or so members that you have, you know, as we heard earlier, checking the checkers and keeping everybody honest. Because I think what's vitally important for us regulators, if we're going to trust the data that's being shared and change our inspection frequencies, for example, then we need to have that confidence. And that confidence we can draw from the separation of the different parts of the system. So there's a scheme owner, right? The certification body is separate. The accreditation body is separate. This isn't, you know, a single body, as I said earlier, marking their own homework. That's three different bodies with separate businesses. So that's a good thing. And if we see a merging of that in any way or excessive control by one scheme owner on an accreditation body, if you follow me, if they are trying to exert an influence on an independent body, then as a regulator, we would take note of that and we would respond accordingly if we felt it was in any way jeopardizing the independence and the trust in that system. So I think the IAF has an important role there, as do the accreditation bodies who as we know, check one another, which is, again, something that we draw confidence from. And I think that's been a theme throughout, the trust and confidence that we can take or derive from accreditation within the third-party ecosystem.
Mike, thanks. Thanks for those comments. And I think that just reinforces my role today as a facilitator, encouraging dialogue, encouraging collaboration. No one has all the answers. And I think it's really important that we have these kind of forums and to bring it to a wider audience with a podcast today. So I'm sure anyone listening today, if you're still with us, that I'm glad you are, because hopefully we've added some value to your day. And people may not always be familiar with the work of IAF or ILAC. There is a number of brochures that you can find on our website. I think another good website that I would recommend is publicsectorassurance.org. That's another one where it talks about how the public sector use conformity assessment, accredited certification to build public policy and ultimately build those bridges between the public and private sector. So take a look at those. I'll wrap up to just reinforce that we have World Accreditation Day on June 9th. So look out for that. This year's theme is Shaping the Future. So very much looking forward about that, about all the challenges the food sector is going to face in the next 10, 20, 30 years, and the role that accreditation will play to support that in the food sector. So I'd just like to thank all of my guests today. So a big thank you to Christina, to Elias, to Cynthia, to Mike, Really appreciate you taking the time to be part of this podcast. And I would just like to thank the audience for listening in today. And I wish you a good rest of your day. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Colin. Thank you, everyone.